Welcome to the debate. So when you unroll a truly ancient map, you have a certain set of expectations, right? You anticipate faded parchment, maybe a really crude, distorted flattening of the world.
Yeah, and usually out toward the edges, you get those illustrations of sea monsters with a warning that says, you know, here be dragons.
Exactly, because you expect to find a landscape of myth. You aren't looking for topography.
Right. It's a window into the psychology of the ancients. It's not a navigation tool you would actually use to find your way around.
Right. But imagine unrolling a 3,000-year-old map, bracing yourself for the mythological dragons, and instead finding a topographic rendering so startlingly precise that it literally mirrors modern satellite imagery.
Oh, wow. Okay.
It forces a really radical question. What if the oldest map of the universe isn't a map of geography, but like a map of physics written in ancient Hebrew? Or alternatively, what if it's a political weapon designed to overthrow an empire?
And that tension is exactly where we find ourselves today. We are looking at the first chapter of Genesis specifically through a comparative lens that bridges Hebrew philology, ancient Near East mythology, and modern scientific cosmology.
Right, because it is widely acknowledged by scholars that this text is not just a simple religious cosmogony. It is a highly complex, deliberate architectural poem.
Yeah, absolutely.
So the central question we are debating is this. Does the primary brilliance of Genesis 1 lie in its political theological subversion of Babylonian myth crafted by exiled scribes to establish order? Or does its true weight come from its uncanny phenomenological mapping of literal scientific cosmology and deep time?
It is such a fascinating divide.
I'll be arguing that Genesis 1 is fundamentally a work of structural architecture and mythological resistance. I see it as a coded text, a theological weapon designed to dethrone the Babylonian gods and construct a sanctuary of memory for a displaced, exiled people.
And I will be taking the position that while the historical context is vital, obviously, the text's most profound feature is actually how its deliberate narrative disorder functions as a hyper-compressed, astonishingly accurate map of physical and biological evolution, tracing the universe from the Big Bang all the way to the Cenozoic era.
Okay, let's just start at the very first word, Bereshit.
Right.
For centuries, in English, this has been translated as the absolute statement, in the beginning, which implies that God created the universe out of absolute nothingness, what theologians call creatio ex nihilo. But if we look at the Hebrew grammar, that simply isn't what the text says.
No, it isn't.
The great 11th century French commentator Rashi pointed out that Bereshit is in what Hebrew calls the construct state.
Which means it implies a temporal subordinate clause. It's grammatically dependent on what follows.
Precisely. So, to explain the mechanism here, the construct state links two nouns together. Think of it like saying, the Queen of England. You can't just say the queen of and put a period.
Right. It just hangs there.
Exactly. It requires the second part to make grammatical sense. So Bereshit doesn't mean in the beginning period. It translates to in the beginning of. The sentence actually reads when in the beginning God created or in the beginning of God's creating.
Which completely shifts the meaning.
It is crucial because it presupposes that something already existed before the action of the narrative began. The text starts with a prior state of disorder. The entire purpose of the poem is not manufacturing matter from scratch. It is the ordering of pre-existing chaos.
Yeah, the chaos is already there.
Right. And this serves as a direct parallel and a theological counterargument to the Babylonian creation epic, the Enuma Elish, which, by the way, opens with the exact same grammatical structure. When on high, the heavens had not yet been named.
Uh-huh.
Both texts start with pre-existing chaos. Genesis is basically a geopolitical argument about who orders that chaos.
See, I come at it from a different way. I agree entirely on the grammatical reality of the construct state. It is absolutely about ordering pre-existing chaos.
Okay.
But what fascinates me is that this grammatical quirk perfectly describes the literal thermodynamic reality of the early universe.
Oh boy, here we go.
No, hear me out. If we look at the Big Bang theory, before the beginning of structured matter, there was a quantum vacuum. This wasn't absolute nothingness. It was a state of potential energy. It was a dense, chaotic sea of subatomic particles. You know, quarks, gluons, photons, just colliding at extreme temperatures.
Right, the cosmic soup.
Exactly. So when the Hebrew text describes a pre-creation state as tohu wabohu, chaos and emptiness, it perfectly mirrors a physical universe just waiting to be structured.
Okay, pause. I know where you're going with this, but if someone is listening to this right now, they are probably thinking, you are about to map quantum thermodynamics onto a Bronze Age poem. I mean, how is that not just incredible confirmation bias?
It sounds like it. I admit, I know it sounds crazy, but the mapping is just too precise to ignore. Consider the underlying mechanics of what happens next. The early universe is expanding, but it is entirely opaque.
Opaque? Like you can't see through it?
Right. It is a blazing fog where light cannot travel because photons are constantly scattering off highly charged particles. Then, the temperature drops just enough for electrons to join nuclei. Neutral atoms form.
Okay.
And in that exact fraction of a second, the photons are freed. The universe becomes transparent. Light can finally travel. Genesis says, "Let there be light." Physics calls this the epic of recombination.
Wait, so you're saying "let there be light" isn't like the lighting of a sun, but the universe cooling?
Exactly. Imagine being inside a neon sign that's turned up so bright, so hot, and so dense that you actually can't see through it. It's just a blinding, opaque soup of energy. That was the early universe.
Wow.
The moment it cooled down, it was like a massive cosmic fog lifted all at once. That is "let there be light." It's the exact moment energy already trapped in chaos finally separates from the darkness.
That's an interesting point, though I would frame it differently. You're looking at the text as a mirror of physics, but the structural clues tell us it's a mirror of ancient geopolitics. Let's look at how the text treats the physical universe in verse 1 and verse 2.
Okay, let's look at it.
Verse 1 uses a merism, the heavens and the earth.
A merism being a figure of speech where you name two opposites to describe the totality of a thing? Like saying you searched a house from top to bottom. You mean the whole house.
Right, exactly. In the ancient Near East, the Sumerians used the phrase Anki, literally heaven-earth, to mean the entire cosmos. But in verse 2, that merism is suddenly cut in half. The heavens vanish from the description and only the earth is described as chaotic and empty.
Hmm.
Why? It's a deliberate editorial choice. A scribe decided it was theologically unfitting for the heavens, God's dwelling place, to be in chaos. So they split the merism. But they left Easter eggs in the text to show what they were really up to.
Easter eggs? Like what?
Verse 2 gives us the Hebrew words tohu for chaos and tiahom for the deep, alongside bohu for emptiness and koshek for darkness.
Right. And linguistically, those trace back to Babylonian roots.
Yes. In the Enuma Elish, the primal forces of chaos are personified as terrifying gods. You have Tiamat, the goddess of the turbulent salt sea. Tohu phonetically echoes Tiamat, and Teahom shares a direct linguistic root with her name.
Okay, I see that.
Alongside her, you have Apsu, the god of the fresh, dark, subterranean deep, which is echoed in the Hebrew word koshek. The text basically hides the Babylonian gods of chaos inside the grammar.
That's fascinating.
And notice how God deals with them. In the Babylonian myth, the storm god Marduk has to violently slaughter Tiamat. He literally splits her body in half to create the world. But in Genesis, the spirit of God simply moves over the face of the deep. God subdues these massive chaos gods, not through cosmic warfare, but by pure presence. It is a profound, bloodless demotion of Babylonian theology.
That's a really compelling argument. But have you considered that the physical descriptions following this are simply too biologically and geologically precise to just be mythic metaphors?
I mean, I think they're metaphors.
Even if we grant the linguistic subversion, look at the rakia, the firmament created on day 2 to separate the waters below from the waters above. For centuries, people thought this was a literal solid glass dome covering a flat earth.
Right, the snow globe model.
Exactly. But chapter 2 gives us a fascinating mechanical detail. It mentions a mist rising from the earth to water the ground long before rain existed.
You're referring to the vapor from the early prehistoric earth. But again, how would an ancient scribe know about planetary vapor? Are you seriously suggesting these ancient scribes had like a meteorological lab?
No, because they were observing the fundamental mechanics of how environments form. Today, we know that deep in the Earth's mantle, there is a mineral called ringwoodite.
Ringwoodite, okay.
Under extreme heat and pressure, the crystalline structure of ringwoodite literally sweats out trapped or H2O molecules. Early volcanic Earth released massive amounts of this trapped water as vapor. Then, in the dark oceans that eventually formed, electrochemical processes created dark oxygen.
Okay, so we're building an atmosphere.
Exactly. Later, cyanobacteria evolved and began pumping massive amounts of oxygen into the atmosphere. When that oxygen met the sun's ultraviolet radiation, it created ozone, the rakia, which translates to something hammered out like a sheet of metal. Perfectly describes this molecular shield.
A sheet of metal as the ozone layer?
Yes. Without the ozone layer physically separating the harsh radiation of space from the waters below, complex life could never have emerged onto dry land.
I see why you think that, but let me give you a different perspective. Treating this text as a peer-reviewed science paper is like reading a cathedral's blueprint and complaining that it doesn't give you the weather report.
Oh, come on.
No, seriously. It fundamentally misunderstands the architecture's purpose. The text is not trying to teach us molecular biology or atmospheric shielding. It is trying to teach us who is in charge.
But how does that explain the precise sequencings? If this is just theology, why are the events ordered the exact way they are?
Let's look at the sequence. Look at day four. On day four, the text deliberately refuses to name the sun and the moon. It calls them the greater light and the lesser light.
Yeah, that is weird phrasing.
Why the evasive language? Because in Babylon, the sun and moon were the explicit gods Shamash and Sin. To name them would be to acknowledge their divinity. So Genesis reduces them to mere instruments. They are just celestial clocks marking time. It even throws in, "He made the stars also," as a grammatical afterthought.
An afterthought, right.
If this were astronomy, the sun and stars would be central. But it's not. It's an act of theological demotion. It is a text tearing down the gods of their captors.
I'm sorry, but I just don't buy that. Let me tell you why. You are claiming the sequence is entirely driven by theological architecture. But if you believe this is just about Babylonian mythology, how do you explain the hyper-specific sequence of the land forming and life evolving?
What do you mean?
The chronology maps flawlessly to geological and biological deep time. Look at day three. Let the waters that are under the heavens be gathered together into one place, and let the dry land appear.
Which just means islands and continents forming.
But look at the phrasing, gather together into one place. This is an exact description of the Paleozoic era. The tectonic mechanics of the Earth drew the land masses together into a single supercontinent, Pangaea, surrounded by a single global ocean, Panthalassa.
Well, technically, the text says the waters gathered into one place, not the land.
True, but to an observer, the visual effect is identical. One contiguous ocean implies one contiguous landmass.
Fair enough.
But it gets more astonishing on day five. The text introduces the Tanin Godolim. Translators have called them sea monsters or dragons, but Tanin literally means lizard or reptile. Godolim means great, great reptiles.
You're saying day five is the dinosaurs.
It perfectly matches the Mesozoic era, the age of the dinosaurs. And what happens next? The text places fish before birds. It tracks the aquatic parenthesis, the millions of years where the seas refilled after the Paleozoic extinction, right before birds evolved directly from bipedal theropod dinosaurs. The Earth literally refined what was on the ground until it learned to rise.
I'm not convinced by that line of reasoning, honestly, because it ignores the structural reality of the poem itself. The sequence isn't an evolutionary timeline. It is deliberately non-chronological.
How is it non-chronological?
Look at the days as structural pairs. Day one creates light. Day four creates the luminaries. Day two separates the waters. Day three gathers the waters. Day five fills the sea and sky. Day six fills the land. It's an architectural symmetry.
I'll give you the symmetry, sure.
And it goes deeper than that. There is a very compelling hypothesis that this entire structure maps to a specific number code. 14-23-56.
A number code. How exactly does that work in the text? Are we, like, counting verses?
We are looking at numerical values and specific keyword occurrences. In the ancient world, if you were a captive in Babylon, you can't openly write a political manifesto saying, "Down with the king of Babylon, David will return." You have to encode it.
Right, that would get you killed.
Exactly. Hebrew scribes used gematria, where letters have numerical values. The name of King David, spelled Daleth Vav Dalet, adds up to 14. That's the archetypal king of Israel.
Okay, 14 is David.
The number 23 points to the 23rd ruler of the Davidic line, King Jehoiakim, who was historically exiled to Babylon in 598 BCE. He took the intellectual elite, the scribes and priests, with him. And 56, in ancient Mesopotamian numerological traditions, represents displacement, a journey without return, exile.
And how does that actually manifest in Genesis 1?
If you analyze the structural repetitions in the Hebrew text, counting how many times structural pillars like the word God is used, or the phrase "and it was so," and how the stanzas are metrically divided, scholars have found this 14-23-56 pattern woven into the very syntax. Genesis is the architecture of memory, for a displaced people organizing their trauma. It's not a timeline of paleontology. It's a monument built out of words so they wouldn't forget who they were in Babylon.
I mean, that is mathematically and poetically beautiful, but it flirts heavily with numerical pareidolia.
Pareidolia?
Yeah, finding patterns in the clouds because you desperately want to see them. Even if there is symbolic architecture embedded in the repetitions, you cannot ignore how day 6 concludes. After the great reptiles of the Mesozoic era are gone, day 6 brings the beasts of the field. 66 million years ago, the Chicxulub asteroid wiped out the dinosaurs. Who inherited the empty world?
Small mammals.
The small adaptable creatures that had been hiding in the shadows. Mammals. The Cenozoic era is the age of mammals, expanding into every ecological niche. And as the absolute culmination of this sequence, we get Homo sapiens, a creature with disproportionately large brains, possessing symbolic consciousness, the ability to name the world, to model the past and the future.
But wait, if this were a pure, scientifically accurate chronology like you're claiming, it fails on its own terms.
How so?
The text would have placed the amphibians and early reptiles, the ones that actually conquered the land in the Paleozoic era, before Pangaea fully formed. Instead, it groups them much later. The sequence isn't tracking biological evolution.
Well,
it is tracking the establishment of domain. First you build the spaces, the light, the firmament, the dry land. Then you populate those spaces with inhabitants, the luminaries, the birds and fish, the animals and humans. Establishing boundaries and filling domains is exactly how you rebuild order from the chaos of exile. It's psychological and structural, not biological.
I agree that it establishes domain, but the phenomenological intuition remains staggering.
You've used that term a couple of times. What exactly do you mean by phenomenological intuition here? Are you saying these scribes had ancient microscopes?
No, not at all. I'm not saying these ancient scribes had telescopes or were doing quantum math in the desert. I'm saying that if you observe the natural world deeply, knowing that water must precede life, that simple systems build into complex systems, that a shield must exist between us and the harshness of the sky, you can intuit the structural logic of the universe.
So it's an extrapolation from observation.
Exactly. The human mind evolved within this universe, so perhaps our deepest intuitions naturally map onto its physical history. From a quantum-like vacuum to a cosmic fog lifting, to a molecular atmospheric shield, to the consolidation of a supercontinent, to the reign of great reptiles, the explosion of mammals, and finally human consciousness. The text compressed hundreds of millions of years into a rhythmic, coherent poem that aligns remarkably with what we only discovered through modern geology and paleontology.
Well, we are approaching the end of our time, so let's synthesize where we stand. From my perspective, Genesis 1 remains one of the most extraordinary texts in human history, precisely because its apparent disorder is actually a deliberate, brilliant architecture.
Yeah.
It is a profound testament to human resilience. We are looking at exiled scribes who used grammar, structural dualities, numerical codes, and veiled language to strip the power away from the massive, terrifying gods of their Babylonian captors. They couldn't build a physical temple in exile, so they constructed a home out of words. The text is a triumph of political theology and mythological resistance.
And my conclusion is that even if the text was heavily edited by those scribes during the Babylonian exile, the final product transcends its historical and political moment. We don't have to claim that the authors possessed anachronistic scientific instruments to be an absolute all of what they accomplished.
Right.
Their sequence demonstrates an intuition about the physical universe that is simply breathtaking. Whether by profound observation of nature, deep psychological resonance, or something else entirely, they managed to map the structural reality of cosmic and biological evolution.
It really speaks to the value of intellectual charity. When we look at ancient material through multiple lenses, refusing to flatten it into just one thing, we discover so much more depth.
Absolutely.
Whether you read it as a masterpiece of political theology decoding the trauma of exile, or as a hyper-compressed phenomenological map of cosmic evolution, the text possesses a coherence that invites endless exploration.
I agree entirely. We bring our modern eyes to an ancient text, and we find that it has been waiting for us all along.
Which brings us back to that ancient map we unrolled at the beginning. You trace your finger along the edges, looking for the myths, looking for the literal dragons of chaos. But the closer you look at the ink, the more you realize the cartographer wasn't just drawing monsters. They were drawing the structure of the world with a precision that still leaves us wondering exactly how they knew where to put the lines.